Today's guest on The Year That Made Me is the grandchild of refugees and the child of Greek immigrants, who was the first person in his family line to go to high school. He went on to found the Asylum Seekers Resource Centre, which from humble beginnings has grown into a not-for-profit that helps more than 7,000 refugees every year. And as our guest has said, it helps to keep the flame of human hope burning brightly in the hearts of all. 25 years after he founded it, Con Karapaniotidis is still the CEO of the Asylum Seekers Resource Centre. Con, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Two generations of your family, Con, left their homeland. Your grandparents were forced to become refugees. Your parents were migrants to Australia. You've described them as people simply who lost the lottery of time and place. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that family story.
Yeah, my grandparents on my father's side, they suffered so deeply. They had to flee the Bundian genocide where more than 500,000 Greeks lost their lives at the hands of Turkey. Having to rebuild their lives from nothing. And I remember when I first met them when I was 10 in Greece and just the harshness and poverty within which they had to raise their children. My father, in fact, was working the fields from the age of 5 and from 9 had to leave school to raise dowries for his 3 sisters and to support his family. So you just think about what a brutal childhood to have. Lots of love, but lots of poverty and struggle. And he would tell me about his memories of having the Nazis occupying his village when he was a little boy. I mean, that's just an extraordinary amount of struggle and suffering to go through at such a tender age.
Yes, and so what was it that made your parents decide to come to Australia?
Neither my father Leo or my mum Sia wanted to come. Like, I think there's a great misnomer that most migrants choose to come here, especially of my parents' generation. They were forced to come here. They weren't fleeing danger, but they were escaping poverty and in search of a better life. And it was their parents on both ends that forced them to leave, saying, we can't see you just struggle and suffer like this and have to live in the same poverty that we do. We want a better life for you. And so both of them reluctantly came to Australia in the 60s and then met here in Melbourne a few years later. And like every migrant story of the time, and you see it today as well, 10, 12, 15 people to a house with their siblings, making ends meet, taking any job they can, with an expectation, as every migrant of that generation had, which was, we'll be for a few years, we'll make enough money to go home and make a better life for our families back there. My mum to this day says, we never plan to stay here. We always plan to go home. And then they start having kids, they start building a whole new community here, and it becomes harder and harder to go back. And that's such a common tale, such a common migrant story.
Yes, you've described your parents as arriving with a suitcase of sacrifice. What was life like for them and then for you being born in Australia but of Greek heritage?
I think back to how did my parents do it? I look at the day and age we're living now, and I'm thinking about, here are two people that arrived in this country with nothing, like actually nothing, couldn't speak a word of English and built a life from scratch, a semi-arranged marriage here in Melbourne. Both were country people, and my dad especially yearned to go back to a small country town. My mum reluctantly followed him out of love and out of commitment, and they started their life in a little country town on Mount Beauty, half an hour from Falls Creek. Just working as tobacco farmers. My dad would be up at 4 in the morning, be working to 10 at night, getting up extra early so my mum could sleep a few more hours. And they raised 2 little kids while being tobacco farmers in the most brutal physical work you could do. And these were the days where you would manually irrigate acres of tobacco fields. How did they do it? I mean, the sacrifice. I'm still just in awe around the profound love and courage and sacrifice of my father and my mum, so that my sister and I could have a better life, could live the dreams. My dad dreamt of being the lawyer I became. My mum dreamt of being a maths teacher. And they both spent their lives being exploited in farms. And then when we moved to Melbourne, in factories filled with asbestos and every other horrible thing. And who does that these days? I mean, the migrant story is just an incredible story of courage and resistance and family and love, isn't it?
Absolutely. The life you've described of your parents, Con, is a hard life, but you've also said that your dad had a way of finding beauty in the most unexpected places. Could you speak a little about that?
Yeah, my dad always believed in beauty. When he moved up to Melbourne when I was 12, he worked at a dye wool factory in Yarra Falls in Collingwood. It's now a bunch of hipster apartments. And back then, it was this disgusting asbestos filled factory. And in one corner of this barren factory was just all this rubbish and weeds and bushes. And my dad cleared it one day asking the bosses, could I plant a flower garden here? And all the men thought he was insane. His boss is like, do what you want, Leo. And in the middle of this disgusting, grimy, barren, brittle factory grew this beautiful flower bed with the most beautiful flowers, roses and pansies and everything in the middle of this barren factory. And all the women at the factory would love my dad because he'd cut them flowers. My dad was so handsome. He was like a Greek James Dean. And he would bring home flowers to my mum each day. And for my dad, it was, he loved gardening. He loved growing things. And no matter how poor we were at times, he said it should never cost us like our humanity and our kindness and our generosity. And they're the values you are taught from your mother and father. We were taught to have love, love for community, to take care of each other, to think about more than just ourselves. We were taught the importance of work and of sacrifice and of taking care of each other. And my father, even when he'd get home at 10 o'clock, he'd be at the fields, on the fields till 9, 10 at night, stop at the Workman's Club in Mount Beauty. And he'd make sure to come back with a chocolate bar for me, just as his little way of letting me know that he loved me and he was thinking of me. I mean, this was a generation where they had none of the luxury of self-care and time out and leave. They just worked every day of the week for their entire adult life until their bodies broke down. They couldn't take it anymore.
We're speaking with Con Karapaniotidis on The Year That Made Me, the founder and CEO of the Asylum Seekers Resource Centre. Con, what was it like for you as a young Greek heritage kid growing up in a very different Australia?
Yeah, it was difficult. You know, I remember once in class, I must have been 8 or 9 years old, and the teacher's putting up that, you know, going, put up your hand if you're Australian. And my hand wouldn't go up. And she turns to me, a little boy, going, but you're born here, you're Australian too. And I'm like, I'm Greek. I'm Greek first. I felt such a pressure as a little boy to assimilate. And I grew up being told to go back to where I came from, being told that I was a wog. I was one of two Greek families and a couple of Italian families in this little town. There was a lot of kindness towards my mum and dad because they worked so hard and they were respected in the community. But as a little boy, you stood out. You know, everyone's a Smith and Jones and you're a Karapaniotidis. There's nowhere to hide in that. So I felt at a very young age what it was like to not belong and what it was like to be othered. And I think that at the time it caused me profound harm, but it was also one of the deepest gifts I learned as an adult because it's what taught me empathy, humility, compassion. It's when you know what it's like to not be wanted and welcomed, you take from that. That's where your character comes from. You learn to be humbled and you learn to be proud of where you come from because you've either got to defend it or disown it. And a lot of migrants feel the pressure to disown it. They shorten their name. Their parents don't teach their kids their language, not out of shame for the culture, but to protect their kids because they're scared that they too will be othered. Like we're seeing today to migrants and refugees, they'll be told they're the bad ones, the unworthy ones, the undeserving ones, the ones without Australian values. And it's like, who are you talking about? You're talking about my mum and dad who did the work no one else would do, who sacrificed and worked hard so my sister and I could contribute to this society 100 times over. Who are they talking about? So it taught me at a very young age to be fiercely proud of who I am and fiercely proud that I come from people who, I don't need them to have had a formal education. They had an education in life and in values and in love and in integrity. And that's the lesson I took from my parents about live with integrity and purpose and be proud of who you are.
Con, you've described how when you were 14 years old, you discovered a book in the school library that didn't just change your life, but you said kind of saved your life. What was that book and what did you get from it?
It was Martin Luther King's Strength to Love, which is my all-time favorite book. It's a book of sermons. I'm not a deeply religious person, but I'm a person that believes in having faith in humanity. And that book was a lifesaver. There I was, this awkward kid. We'd moved to Melbourne. I was going to, at the time, what was one of the worst public schools in Melbourne. And I was being bullied at school constantly. And I was an awkward kid. Like, I had a mustache by the age of 12, like a proper mustache. I had a monobrow. I stood out from other kids. I was awkward around girls. And I was just being bullied day in, day out. And I felt so worthless and useless and unlovable and strange. And I remember I joined high school there in September of year 7. So I'd missed all the bonding and connecting. And I just stood out. And there was this book Strength to Love, and this book was all about take the path less traveled. It's okay not to fit in. It's okay to not conform. It's okay to have principles and beliefs and values. And the very things that I believed in were the things I would be humiliated and mocked for. And there was this person talking about that courage and empathy and compassion were not the things of fools, but the things of leaders and people with principles. And it's okay to be alone if you're on the right side of an issue and on doing the right thing. That gave me comfort and assurance that I needed to hear at the time. And I took those lessons and I've carried with them all my life.
We're getting close to the year that made you, Con, now. Mm. Before we identify that year, could you tell us a little bit about sort of where you were in your early 20s to set the scene?
Yeah. By the time I'd got into the end of high school, I was very much at a crossroads. I was like, you know, a typical young man, low on self-esteem, feeling kind of overwhelmed by the sort of trauma that I'd grown up around, really struggling for a sense of worth and purpose, and thinking, what am I going to do with myself? And I, thank goodness, took the path of, if I don't feel a deep sense of love for myself, I can give that love to others. And what I spent my early 20s doing was probably an unusual path for most young men. I spent it out there volunteering and, you know, out there helping community. So every second Sunday, I'd be at the children's hospital. Wednesday nights, I'd be at the now defunct crisis line, taking telephone calls from people calling, saying they're thinking of ending their lives. And there I was all of 21, 22, trying to talk them out of ending their lives. On my Friday and Saturday nights, I'd be out there outreaching the streets of St. Kilda, supporting people sex working to sex work safely, be helping out in homeless soup kitchens. And what I found, everywhere I was volunteering was this incredible gift, which were, here were people that were accepting me and embracing me. At uni, I was struggling to make friends. I believed in the importance of education. I was determined to get that education, but I could not fit in anywhere still. But there I was volunteering with people that had lost everything, that had nothing, but they hadn't lost their compassion and kindness towards me. And what I saw were people that weren't broken and failed and undeserving people, but people who, because of trauma, a mental health crisis, the end of a marriage, the loss of their child, of something that had put them into a position of crisis. And what they missed out on was someone there to catch them, someone there to keep them safe and show them love. And so what I found in community was a place where all the things in me that I thought were the worst of me were the gifts in me, where all that stuff I'd gone through was some of the things that allowed me to show empathy and compassion and kindness. And so me as a young man was not one with much friends or any social life. And I just really threw my life into caring for my community and getting an education. And that was, being frank with you, that was most of my 20s. I was a bit of a social nerd. I didn't really have much of a life outside of that. And I just lost myself in that, but I kind of found myself in that and it did save me. I don't know what I would have done without that, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, it sounds like an extraordinarily fulfilling, but also very busy and emotionally demanding life, Con.
Oh, look, a lot to be doing at the age of 20. But the thing that I had from what my parents had taught me and what I'd gone through was resilience and empathy. Things that you can't teach, things that you have to live. And I think all those experiences gave me a deep sense of purpose and an understanding that it's so easy to punch down on people that are struggling and that are barely keeping afloat. We're way too quick to demonize and dehumanize people rather than go, hey, that's someone's child, that's someone's mum or dad, that's someone who once upon a time had the same dreams as we did. And what about if we led with some love and empathy towards them rather than just thought they were disposable? No one's disposable. It's like the way we talk about young people. There are no bad young people born bad. You know, and the idea is that you're just going to, the solution to helping young people at risk is to just incarcerate them. The solution is to wrap around love and opportunity and care for those children. So I think that's what I learned. I learned about look after your community and be a good neighbor. In Greek culture, my favorite word is philoxenia, which is to welcome the stranger, to have love for the stranger. The understanding that you could be the stranger, you could be the one seeking help, and what would you want? And I know what I would want. I would want love and welcome and care and kindness. And that's a universal value. You know, it's not an Australian value, it's a universal value. And that's what we need to be returning to. And that's what my 20s also taught me, was the importance of leading with love. Always, no matter what, lead with love and it will take care of you.
So, Con Karapaniotidis, what year have you chosen as the year that made you and why?
I was thinking at the moment, we're having this discussion around men and men's mental health. And I talk a lot about every week in this country, a woman is killed by the violence of men. Every day in this country, seven men lose their life to to suicide, and we're having a debate around men's mental health, and we rarely have a debate that is honest and constructive and healthy around what do men do with the trauma and grief. And I was thinking about the worst year of my life, the year 2000, which was the year my dad died. And I chose to talk about that one because I think more men need to hear about men grieving and what do we do with our grief. So I decided to choose that year because it profoundly shaped everything I did after that. But it also profoundly shattered me at the time. My sister and I had saved for months to finally give my mum and dad a chance to go back to Greece on a holiday. And my dad hadn't been to Greece and seen his parents in 15 years, I think. And we'd saved and saved, and they finally got to go back, and he finally got back to see his sisters and see his family, my mum the same. And then I get a call from my mum, and she's like, your father has died. And I think it was 10 days before they were due to come back. He'd had a heart attack in the middle of the night. My mum just found him there. And yeah, so it's what stays with me. I was 27 at the time. And, you know, everything you think at the time, that by living a good life and by living a life of love and kindness and compassion, that it will protect you as well. That really bad things like this won't happen to you if you live this good life. And you realize nothing can protect you. And so when I lost my dad, I wanted to die with him. You know, I just wanted the earth to stop. I didn't want to be here anymore. And it brought up so much grief. It brought up so much regret. It brought up so much pain for me.
Yeah. So, Con, could you speak a little bit more about how your feelings about the circumstances in which your dad died very suddenly, but also in his homeland and as the result of an act of love and generosity from his kids, how have your feelings and thoughts about what happened changed over the years?
Oh, look, it's really complex, and that's part of why I chose to share it. Part of the complex is a guilt. Part of me feels like I killed my dad by thinking he was in a remote little Greek village when he suddenly died. If he was here at the time, could we have saved him? Would he be alive if I hadn't sent him on a holiday? And the other part that I think lots of men can relate to when they lose their dads is the relationship I had when my dad loved me deeply. My dad had so much trauma and came from a generation where they didn't have those words. They didn't have the luxury of being able to get in touch with their feelings and be able to talk in that way. My dad had suffered through so much, and I had so much regret about all the things I never asked him about, all the things I didn't share with him. He had worked from the age of 9 to 61 and was dead at 63, and we'd forced him to retire. And just as my sister and I were in a position to start looking after him, to think finally we can take our dad and let him travel and let him not worry about money and get whatever he wants for his garden. And just when it was our turn to look after him, he was gone. And a lot of the regret was, God, I wish I had been kinder to him and understood him more. It was so hard at the time because my mum and dad were doing their best, but they grew up with so much intergenerational trauma themselves and were struggling to cope with life and struggling to do everything and be everything. And a lot of men, I think we regret when we lose our fathers, going, we wish we were closer, and I wish I'd shared more, and I wish I'd been more compassionate and kinder. And from that experience, it taught me, well, what do I do now with this grief? I can't let this grief just consume me and destroy me or break me or make me bitter and hateful, because I felt so wronged at the time, going, how could the universe do this to me after all I have given and done? But that if I went down that path, it would have, I don't know what it wouldn't have been good. I was taking me down a very dark path, and I'm like, I cannot, and what would my dad want of me? My dad was the sort of person that he was just trusted and loved because he was a man of such integrity and honesty and hard work. And I thought, what would my dad want? My dad would want me to continue to be the man that he raised me to be. And that's what I decided to do with that grief. I go, that grief is either going to consume me, or maybe that grief can teach me just the importance of being the loving, caring human being that he raised me to be, and to keep being that person even more.
So is there a connection between that loss and grief that you were feeling, Con, and the fact that it was in the next year, 2001, that you founded the Asylum Seeker Resource Center?
Oh, look, very much so. I lost my dad in September of 2000, and in June of 2001, less than a year later, I started that. And very much what I established in the Asylum Seeker Resource Center is all driven by my dad's memory and my mum, because That's what inspired me, wanting to make sure that the next people like my mum and dad, that they would have a place to be welcomed and safe and cared for. And I thought there's no better way of doing that than by helping other people that are coming to this country as refugees. That's what I try to teach my staff, that everyone that comes through that door, that could be your parents or grandparents, and what would you want for them? And I hope I make my dad proud making that choice. And at the time, I was in such a dark place. I was also trying to be there for my mum and my sister, and also going, I've got to do something. Something good has to come from this. And I think that also gave me the strength to keep going. And it allowed me, I think, to take all that grief and channel it into something positive. And suddenly I found myself welcoming people into our doors that, you know, reminded me of my father. Fathers who themselves had crossed the sea and sacrificed everything to save their families.
Mm.
While my father wasn't fleeing persecution, he spent his life sacrificing everything so that he could protect his children. And so, yeah, that's, I can't think of a better way to honor my dad.
Con, we've heard about the huge amounts of social work that you'd done, but you'd also become qualified as a lawyer, and that's been a part of the services that Asylum Seekers Resource Centre has provided. Could you tell us about your first appearance in the High Court?
Yeah, I never got to practice law outside of what I do at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. You know, most people spend a couple of years in corporate law, they learn the ropes, and there I was, still in my 20s, and there were these dozen families who were due to appear before the High Court, and they pleaded with me, please, can you come with us to our first hearing? And I'm like, okay, look, I'll come this one time. I can't go on beyond that. So I'm walking down to the High Court to go before a single judge, Justice Haynes. And as we're going up there, they all start pulling out all these letters from all the three different law firms the government employed. And all the letters are like, we're going to strike this matter out. We're going to seek to have this matter dismissed. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm in so much trouble. I get to the registry and I see all these sunken faces, more than a dozen more families just sitting there and going, is there anyone else here who needs a lawyer? And all the hands shoot up. And I'm like, okay, follow me in. I'm now your lawyer. So I've got now more than two dozen people lined up in a row. And I am not exaggerating when I'm saying I had no idea what the High Court rules were. I wasn't even sure what to call the judge. I remember the yellow highlighter and just had highlighted the case numbers of everyone. I didn't even have a copy of the law. It was like I was the vibe in the castle.
Yeah, this is not the usual way that people make their first appearance in the High Court.
Really, it really wasn't. And the judge turns to me and goes, are these all your clients? I'm like, yes, they are. And on the other side, I kid you not, there were a dozen plus lawyers, barristers, trolleys of legal precedent, all lined up. And I get up. And using every $10 word I had in me, I spoke for half an hour, I lost count, just speaking about these poor people who were impoverished, had these matters on foot for almost a decade. And suddenly, with less than a week before their hearing, they suddenly got given all these letters saying they were going to seek to strike their cases out rather than list them. And I just spoke about the injustice of this, that these people deserve their day in court. And I just kept speaking until I ran out of words. And then I sit down, the judge turns to them. Unfortunately, the judge knew the High Court rules and he says, is this right? You've short-served these people under the High Court rules and haven't given them appropriate notice? He spent the next hour ripping shreds off them, turns to me and goes, would you like to proceed today or adjourn? I go, let me get my instructions. I turn to the row of people and I shake my head going, no, no. And they're like, no, no, Your Honor, we don't want to proceed today. We get a temporary stay for a bit over a month and we walk out and everyone's literally cheering. And I'll never forget that lesson. That lesson was systems that seek to harm and oppress people rely on no one showing up or giving us stuff. And the lesson for me was forget about your ego and your fears. Just do the courageous and right thing. The greatest risk to injustice is being a bystander and not showing up and doing your best. And I've carried that lesson with me for more than two decades. Be brave, be courageous, and be on the right side of history, regardless of the cost. It sounds so obvious, but we live in a day and age where doing the moral thing is a radical thing these days. Being empathetic is a radical thing these days. So I say to people, it's time for radical empathy. And that's what I see in my work 25 years later. We turned 25 on the 8th of June, and I wish we weren't here, but it's been a blessing to work with the most courageous and brave and extraordinary human beings, which is what refugees are. And it's the greatest honor of my life is to do this work. And that's why I still have hope in all this darkness is what a blessing and honor to play a small part in people having their freedom and being able to save their lives. And tens of thousands of people are alive because 25 years ago in this moment of grief, I thought, let's do something that's about love and community.
Con, as you said, after founding it 25 years ago, there's been a huge amount that the Asylum Seekers Resource Centre has achieved. When you look back over that time, are there particular achievements or maybe just moments from your work that are the most special to you?
Yeah, look, everything I've done has been thanks to the, you know, thousands of people that have volunteered and worked and helped over the years. It's always a collective effort and tens of thousands of people who support our work. And then the little stories, one of my favorites were a couple of years ago, I was really humbled to receive an honorary doctorate of laws. And there I was with my mum, and this young woman comes up to me. She was dressed all beautiful in her graduation. She goes, "I need to meet your mum." And so she gives my mum a big hug. She then introduces me to her parents and her sister and goes, "When we were 5, 6 years of age, we came to your organization and you fought for our family and got us asylum and helped furnish our home when we had nothing. And today I'm the first of my family to graduate from university. And we just want to say thank you." I mean, that's what it's all about. And every day when you see people that have come with nothing, who have saved themselves, because, you know, refugees have saved themselves to get here. But just when you then see them graduating and starting their first small business and getting their first diploma or being able to get permanency and go to university, and they're so desperate to contribute and give back. Or sometimes meeting some of the kids you got out of detention who were going to die in detention and now they're adults and they're thriving. I mean, it's just a greater honor and gift than that around the gift of hope and life and of freedom. I mean, to play a small little part in making that possible is special. So I don't want to forget any of the horror that I've seen, and I don't even want to become numb and detached to it, because that's part of this country's history. And I also want to hold on to the hope and the joy and the possibilities of what has also been won. And I think 25 years ago to now, from the days of the Tampa to now, what I'm also humbled by is watching this country shift to wanting to be more compassionate towards refugees and migrants, despite what you might be reading. Most Australians are good and decent and welcoming. And I believe in that. You have to. What's the alternative? And I want to keep building this very simple idea. What does it mean to be a good neighbor? It's that simple. A good neighbor looks after its neighbors, shows up for its neighbors, protects its neighbors, and understands that its neighborhood is only as strong as each other. And the idea that somehow our differences are some sort of threat or risk or burden. No greater lie has been told to our humanity. And those differences is what makes this country so precious and beautiful, this 65,000-year-old extraordinary Indigenous multicultural nation. And I feel blessed to be part of it and for the opportunities it's given me and my family. Man, I want to protect it. I want to protect that country and protect those values against those who seek to divide us and harm us and dehumanize us. I will not let that happen. And that's part of what keeps me going, is I refuse to be a bystander. I never will.
Con Karapaniotidis is the founder and CEO of the Asylum Seekers Resource Centre. If you want to hear more about Con's personal story, you can check out his memoir, The Power of Hope. And Con mentioned earlier that word philoxenia. That's also the name of another of his books, Philoxenia, A Seat at My Table, a cookbook of vegetarian and vegan Greek recipes, co-authored with his mother. Con, thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
My pleasure, my honour. Thank you so much for having me.
And Con, we always finish The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. What have you chosen for us and why?
I chose Yothu Yindi's Treaty because right now there's a walk for truth and a call for a national truth-telling process. And now more than ever, we need truth and treaty in this nation. And that's why that's the song I've chosen.
Con, thanks again.
Thank you.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.